This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, July 9th, 2010. In New York, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up on today's newscast, residents of Oakland respond to the verdict in the case of a police officer who shot and killed an unarmed black man. We'll take a look at the Pentagon's new pick to head military operations in the Middle East. In the Gulf Coast, concern grows over health risks to oil spill cleanup workers. And the World Cup ends this weekend. We'll hear from South Africa about a clampdown on civil rights and the tournament's mixed results for the local economy. Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. A federal judge in Boston has struck down a section of the 14-year-old Federal Defense of Marriage Act, declaring it unconstitutional to deny financial benefits to same-sex married couples. For FSRN, David Goodman has more from Massachusetts.
U.S. District Court Judge Joseph Toro had two cases before him, both of which challenged Section 3 of the 1996 Federal Defense of Marriage Act. Referred to as DOMA, the bill mandates that only heterosexual married couples are eligible for federal health and other benefits. In his ruling Thursday, Toro said DOMA's denial of federal benefits to same-sex couples in effect creates a separate class of people, violating the Equal Protection Clause of the U.S. Constitution. Earlier this year, Justice Department lawyers said the government had legitimate interest in trying to preserve marriage as a heterosexual institution. But Judge Toro countered that he found no basis for the idea that denying benefits to same-sex couples makes heterosexual marriages more secure. As expected, gay rights groups cheered the decision, while opposition organizations criticized Toro as an activist judge. Legal scholars on both sides of the issue say appeals of the decision are likely to reach the U.S. Supreme Court. Dave Goodman, FSRN, Boston.
In other GLBT news, Presbyterian church leaders have voted to allow non-celibate gay and lesbian clergy members who are in committed relationships to serve. But by a slim margin, the church has declined to change language that would sanction same-sex marriage. Both would have to be approved by a larger group of church leaders to become official policy. A top state lawyer in West Virginia says the state legislature should decide how to replace the late Senator Robert Byrd. Legal counsel Jonathan Deem advised the governor that he should call a special session of the legislature. Democrats in Congress are relying on Byrd's replacement to help with final passage of the financial reform legislation. In Pakistan, a suicide attack near a gathering of people waiting to pick up wheelchairs for their family members left dozens dead. Many believe the attack was in response to local meetings, or jirga, where elders are trying to form their own group to fight back. Gabe Matthews reports from Pakistan.
More than 80 tribal people died and 150 others were injured in the suicide attack near a Mohammed Agency government building. An eyewitness told FSRN on condition of anonymity that the ground was littered with human remains.
Most of the dead and injured are young people. The tensions are rising. There is a peace process going on in our area, and that would be the main reason to attack, to create chaos and uncertainty. The other reason would be to target the local government administrator.
The blast happened in front of the administration office, which is near the main jail. Because of damage to the prison, many inmates, including some militants, were able to escape. Local Taliban have accepted responsibility for the attack and say they will continue to attack anyone who stands against them. I am Scott Pham, reading for Gabe Matthews in Pakistan.
A prison fire in Uruguay has killed 12 inmates. Today, authorities are investigating why it took so long to evacuate the men from the overcrowded facility. FSRN's Manuela Aldalbe reports.
The fire started early Thursday morning in the small town of Rocha, east of the capital Montevideo. The 300-square-foot cell where the fire started housed 20 people. 12 of them died in the blaze, and the other 8 are being treated for injuries. Authorities suspect a short circuit in a personal heater sparked the fire. In a video filmed on a mobile phone by an inmate in another cell, you can hear people yelling for the guards to open the door.
Abra!
but the video shows they were hesitating, apparently trying to decide what to do. By the time he unlocked the door, it was too late. The government is investigating the incident. Humanitarian conditions in the prisoner here are notoriously bad. The Rocha prison hosted nearly three times the inmate it was designed to hold. President José Mujica said that the government is working on a new law to alleviate prison overcrowding. Prisoners in the Rocha jail have gone on hunger strike to protest the tragedy. Manuel Aldave, Free Speech Radio News, Montevideo.
And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
This is Dorian Marina in New York. A jury in Los Angeles released a lesser guilty verdict in the case of Oakland BART officer Johannes Messerly. Messerly, who is white, shot and killed 22-year-old Oscar Grant, who is black, while he lay unarmed at a BART platform on New Year's Day in 2009. Messerly's guilty verdict for involuntary manslaughter carries a lighter sentence than second-degree murder, the charge the prosecution was seeking. He faces up to 4 years in prison, plus additional time because the crime included a gun. Yesterday, Grant's mother, Wanda Johnson, reacted to the verdict.
My son was murdered. He was murdered. He was murdered. He was murdered. My son was murdered. And the law has not held the officer accountable the way that he should have been held accountable.
In Oakland, an afternoon of expressing anger and frustration turned to rage for some as store windows were smashed and a handful of stores were looted. FSRN's Andrew Stelzer was there and files this report.
As residents learned of the verdict of involuntary manslaughter, the general sentiment was not one of surprise, but of resigned disappointment.
For me, they gave him sympathy. Because he's a white officer.
It's not so much about racism, but it's just like, as long as he got a bash, they're not going to like do nothing to him.
Well, you know, it's state-sanctioned murder. I mean, white guy, regardless if he's a police or not, he killed a black man. This is what's happening in Oakland, it's happening in Texas, it's happening in New York. Voluntary manslaughter is nothing.
I think if he got convicted of second-degree murder, it probably would have mended a little bit more of the community with the police. But now this just makes it even worse.
For weeks, Oakland's city government and community leaders have planned what to do in the hours after the verdict. Thousands of local, regional, and state police were brought in, and the National Guard was on call. Numerous groups called for rallies and speak-outs following the verdict. While officials designated a plaza in front of Oakland City Hall for a demonstration, people instead took over a nearby intersection. Meanwhile, on adjacent streets, smaller groups of protesters butted up against lines of riot police. Oakland City Councilmember Desley Brooks was one of several peacekeepers standing between a surging crowd of protesters and a line of police.
They are standing down. If they wanted to advance on you, they could have done that a long time ago.
Against who?
They are trying to allow you guys to express yourselves.
Down the street, dozens of others took to a mic on a makeshift stage, expressing rage, frustration, disappointment, and for the most part, calling for peace.
What do we do from here? Do you have an organization that you struggle with? Do you have a group of people that you organize with to make your life better? Do you understand how easy it was for us to shut down the city of Oakland? Look around right now. Nothing is moving downtown. Nothing. You did this. You did this.
Oscar Grant's cousin, Medea, also spoke. She was with him the night he was killed.
Turn around and hold somebody hand. That's your brother. That's your sister. We gotta love each other more out here.
Comedian Mark Curry, a native Oaklander, called on the crowd to be peaceful.
We're happy and we're sad. We're happy that the word guilty has come with an unarmed shooting of a black man by a police officer. More than 30 years, you haven't heard that word. We are happy on that point, but we want more.
Curry reminded the roughly 800 people assembled that former officer Messerly still will face a civil trial and could be tried in federal court. The Department of Justice has said its Civil Rights Division, along with the FBI and U.S. Attorney's Office, are investigating and considering prosecution.
There will be justice. We have to stay organized. That's the main thing. They want us to go crazy so they can do martial law. But we're not going to do that, are we?
No.
We're going to show them something different.
But after the city ordered the open mic shut down at 8, chaos similar to January of 2009 ensued. As store windows were broken and trash bins set on fire, police chased about 150 people through downtown Oakland for several hours. 83 people were arrested. Emiliano Raul says he understands the rage people are feeling.
It's unfocused, obviously, and it doesn't seem to make a lot of sense to go bust up some local beauty supply store, but also it feels like it's a dead end. You know, the justice system failed, and like, it's obviously not a constructive channel, but I don't see any other constructive outlets, and I'm sure that's how people feel here. Justice won't be served.
The California Highway Patrol says they will continue to back up the Oakland police throughout the weekend. There are also numerous community meetings scheduled in the next week. Andrew Stelzer, FSRN, Oakland.
The Defense Department is recommending General James Mattis to replace General David Petraeus to head Central Command, the military division that oversees the Middle East and Central Asia. The opening came when Petraeus was tapped to replace General Stanley McChrystal after he was fired for disparaging comments he made to a Rolling Stone reporter. As FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports, General Mattis is also not camera shy.
When you Google General James Mattis, the first thing that comes up are the words, "It's fun to shoot people."
It's a hell of a hoot. It's fun to shoot some people. I'll be right up on you. I like brawling.
He said that at a panel discussion in San Diego in 2005. But he also said more. Listen closely.
You go into Afghanistan, you got guys who slapped women around for 5 years because they didn't wear a veil. You know, guys like that ain't got no manhood left anyway, so it's a hell of a lot of fun to shoot them.
He said it's fun to shoot men in Afghanistan who slap women around for not wearing a veil. With Senate confirmation, General Mattis would be General Petraeus' boss and the top military commander for Afghanistan, Iraq, and the surrounding region. In an announcement to reporters Thursday, Defense Secretary Robert Gates defended Mattis, who was not punished for his violent remarks, but told to choose better words.
It was 5 years ago. Appropriate action was taken at the time. I think that the subsequent 5 years have demonstrated that the lesson was learned.
In the aftermath of the Rolling Stone article that cost General McChrystal his job, Secretary Gates revised the Pentagon's media strategy to fix what he calls disorganized and sloppy relationships with the press. General Mattis is known for his knowledge of ground warfare, which some say has contributed to his sharp tongue and sometimes witty and off-the-cuff remarks. But he's also known to be a revered intellectual and to be culturally aware. Secretary Gates called him, quote, the military's most innovative and iconoclastic thinker. Major General Paul Eaton is with the liberal-leaning National Security Network. He served with General Mattis in Iraq.
Those remarks did not translate into an attitude of gratuitous violence in Iraq, quite the opposite.
According to the book Fiasco, he told his soldiers in Iraq to remove the barrier when talking to Iraqis, their sunglasses, and to not rough up the male of the household when searching homes. Lawrence Korb, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, says Mattis's outspoken ways are a plus.
Mattis has been in a lot of combat in both places. And I think basically that, you know, if he disagrees with the strategy, for example, he will not be afraid to say that.
Mattis must be confirmed by the Senate before he takes on his new position. Leanne Caldwell, FSRN, Washington, D.C.
This weekend, the month-long FIFA World Cup comes to a close in South Africa with a final game between Spain and the Netherlands. But as viewers across the world tune in to watch the final, activists in South Africa are bringing attention to some of the negative effects of hosting the biggest sporting event in the world and threats to civil rights and the local economy. To discuss these issues, we're joined by Patrick Bond, who directs the Center for Civil Society in Durban and has been closely monitoring the World Cup in South Africa. Welcome to FSRN.
Thanks, Dorian. Great to be with you.
Let's start with what happened last weekend. You were detained along with other activists while handing out flyers at a World Cup venue. What happened?
Well, we learned that the World Cup venues, including a fan fest on the beach here in Durban, where 20, 30,000 fans at a time can watch on a big screen instead of going to the stadium, is actually a FIFA-owned and controlled space, even though it's public space, the beach. And so by giving out flyers, in this case it was about a rally against xenophobia, a big fear after the World Cup, and we were giving out leaflets to people, and the police immediately detained us, and they did so the second night after we figured they might have a rethink, but they didn't. So we've really learned that this Zurich-based corporation, FIFA, which is the governing body of world soccer, when they come into a country, they really try and make it their little sovereign space, and they make it an exclusive commercial zone for their partners, the biggest corporations in the world. And then they eviscerate your local democratic rights, even in a country like South Africa, where we fought so long and hard for them.
Well, FIFA stands to make billions of dollars in profits from this World Cup. Will it go to South Africa? Will they pay taxes there?
No, it's a tiny trickle down, but in fact, $3.2 billion is what they've announced as profits already. That's more than 50% more than they took out of Germany the last World Cup, 2006. And they don't pay taxes, nor are exchange controls in effect. And even their corporate partners don't pay taxes. And the trickle down we were anticipating, for example, that they would build some stadiums in the low-income black townships, or that there'd be opportunities for small businesses to get some of the action, none of that's really panned out, not even on the tourism front, because they overestimated dramatically how many rich northern foreigners would fly down, and with the world recession and the distance, that's really not panned out at all. So on a whole variety of fronts, it's been a terrible disappointment, notwithstanding the excitement for the society to host this great event and the beauty of the soccer. Still, people are beginning to ask, was it worth it?
Well, the benefits from this tournament, or who it benefits, is still an important question. Now, before the tournament began, there was concern of racial tensions and protests taking place. Much of that hasn't materialized, but there have been some important social actions that took place. Could you tell us about some of those, and also what it means for South Africa after this tournament leaves?
Well, there have been three processes of civil unrest that have been high on the agenda. One is the labor movement, which used the World Cup, the run-up to it, for very, very substantial wage increases, in some cases double the inflation rate. So they were very effective in using their power and maximizing it. A second group of grievances would be expressed by ordinary communities, and there have been fewer of them and fewer reported over this period. But the fact that the electricity prices have just gone up 25% to me suggests that within days we're going to see more of those urban protests that have made South Africa famous again. But the third type of protest is the independent left, the social movements. There has been quite a bit of drama associated with the labor struggles. And what with our extreme inequality and knowledge and commitments to getting out on the streets on all manner of issues, whether it's AIDS medicines or fighting water privatization or all of the sort of day-to-day issues that so many people care about have motivated them. The World Cup will come and go, and rich people have gotten a lot richer, but these underlying conditions will continue to get worse.
Well, the final game is this Sunday, and as you say, these important issues will continue. Patrick Bond is a professor at the University of KwaZulu-Natal and the director of the Center for Civil Society in Durban, South Africa. He spoke to us about the World Cup closing this weekend. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
A federal appeals court in Louisiana rejected the Obama administration's attempts to reinstate a six-month ban on deepwater drilling in the Gulf of Mexico. The decision from the three-judge panel came down late Thursday and ruled in favor of companies that argue that they are being financially hurt by the moratorium on drilling. The Interior Department says a ban is necessary in order to avoid another oil disaster. The federal government may attempt to issue a second temporary ban in response to the ruling. Meanwhile, as the BP oil disaster approaches its third month, questions on the long-term effects of pollutants on the environment may become more prevalent. FSRN's Kyle Barnett explores one of those questions in his look at the health concerns of oil spill cleanup workers in Louisiana.
Louisiana's Department of Health and Hospitals says that exposure to low levels of chemicals in the oil itself and in the dispersant Corexit may cause irritation of the eyes, nose, throat, and skin, and that people with asthma or other lung diseases may be more sensitive to these effects. In addition, particulate matter, which is basically a very fine ash from burning oil, may also pose a greater risk for people who have chronic conditions such as asthma or heart disease. As of July 7th, 166 oil spill cleanup workers and 33 people from the general population have visited local hospitals, clinics, and doctors' offices with exposure-related symptoms. Dr. Lou Ann White is a toxicologist and director of the Center for Applied Environmental Health at Tulane University.
I think that if there are levels of these volatiles, they should be wearing respirators. If there's, you know, definite established levels that, you know, above a certain level, they should have a respirator. If they are doing burning such that they could be inhaling that smoke, they should be wearing respirators.
BP and government officials continue to say that respirators aren't needed for all workers. However, as of last week, officials said respirators will now be provided to workers in controlled burn areas for use when there are elevated levels of toxins. BP is conducting air quality testing, including through personal air monitors. But the company says their tests only adhere to levels of allowable toxins as established by the Occupational Health and Safety Administration, or OSHA. Dr. White explains.
Well, OSHA guidelines are many times out of date, but that's, you know, that's the legally enforceable one. But any industrial hygienist, I know the best practices, they use the ACGIH or the NIOSH, which are more updated. So you may have a legal limit, but then you have the best practices of the profession. And every case I know, people use the best practice of a profession.
Air sampling test results published on BP's website show that the levels of benzene, hydrocarbons, and 2-butoxyethanol, the potentially hazardous ingredient in Corexit, do not meet safety standards set forth by the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, or NIOSH. NIOSH compiles information at a federal level on what practices should be followed in the workplace, but unlike OSHA, NIOSH does not have the ability to enforce their recommendations. BP has garnered further criticism for contracting the Center for Toxicology and Environmental Health, or CTEH, as their primary air quality testers. The Louisiana Bucket Brigade has observed controversial CTEH practices on past oil spills, says Director Ann Rolfes.
And in their entire existence, they have never found a problem, right? They've never found that there is any cause for concern.
Rolfes' main concern is that CTEH's current testing is limited to short-term exposure.
It's not, could this exposure cause you cancer in 5 or 10 years or 20 years? It's, are you going to die right now, and do we need to evacuate you?
Rolfes' sentiment is shared by others who are also criticizing BP for failing to provide full disclosure of test results. Stephen Herman with the law firm Herman Katz & Kotler said BP has not been forthcoming with in-depth air sample testing information which may show that workers have been exposed to levels of potentially hazardous compounds that are high enough to sicken them.
Because they submitted an affidavit that just says, oh, well, these levels aren't high enough to warrant respiratory devices. So our question as lawyers is, well, where's the beef? You know, show us the money. Where's the data that supports that? What sampling are you doing? How frequently? What locations? What are your protocols? What are the test results?
Herman says he has several clients who may pursue lawsuits against BP due to neglect of worker safety. Kyle Barnett, Free Speech Radio News, New Orleans.
Lawmakers and federal officials continue hearings on the proposed merger between Comcast and NBC Universal. A House subcommittee hearing took place in Chicago on Thursday, and next week, the FCC is holding a hearing there as well. Many of those opposed to the mega merger say it could threaten diversity in the media. Leilani Albano reports.
If approved, Comcast, the largest cable and internet access provider, will acquire more than a dozen local TV stations, more than a dozen cable networks, including NBC's news divisions, Telemundo, and Universal Pictures and theme parks. Comcast would control 51% of the company, while NBC Universal's parent company, GE, would have 49%. This gives Comcast NBC Universal unprecedented control over the web, as well as the production and distribution of broadcast content.
It's a serious problem.
Kim Gandy, vice president of the Feminist Majority, is among the growing number of opponents who say the merger will lead to fewer independent voices, a loss of net neutrality, and less diversity as well.
The more consolidation there is among large media conglomerates, the more voices are edged out.
Stop Big Media, a coalition made up of dozens of labor unions, advocacy groups, and community organizations, also opposes the merger. Corey Wright, policy counsel for the advocacy group Free Press, says the merger will squeeze out women and people of color from ownership positions.
It does erect barriers to new entrants, many of whom would be women or people of color, to bring new and independently owned channels to your cable roster.
Comcast, who declined to be interviewed for this story, states on its website that 60% of its staff is made up of women and minorities. However, only one person of color and one woman sits on its executive board. Comcast announced last month that it is expanding its diversity efforts by providing three independently owned cable networks, the most that a major media conglomerate has offered. But many remain skeptical. Ravi Kapoor is CEO of the San Francisco-based South Asian television network, DIA, and a reporter for NBC affiliate station KSBW in Salinas. He won't say whether or not he supports the Comcast NBC Universal plan for fear of retaliation. But he says media consolidations in general are bad for minorities.
If you don't have, you know, locally owned television stations any longer, do you think the corporate conglomerates have an interest in serving these different communities? No, they have an interest in streamlining their costs.
According to Free Press, people of color own only about 3% of all commercial television stations. For women, that number is just under 6%. Opponents also cite Comcast and NBC Universal's record. In 2008, NBC Universal gutted its Spanish news programming at Telemundo stations in California cities such as San Jose and moved them out of state. Others say Comcast hasn't supported independent ethnic channels. Catherine Galan is the executive director of the National Association of Latino Independent Producers.
In their service provision and in the way they've treated multi-ethnic channels, not been particularly positive.
Another group, the National Coalition of African American-Owned Media, says Comcast refuses to add more independent black channels to its lineup. The group also accuses the company of running the wholly owned Black Family Channel off the airwaves by charging exorbitant launch fees. National Coalition founder Stanley Washington.
If this is their conduct while they're trying to secure approval for the largest media acquisition in history, how do we think they're going to act when they get approved?
Groups also fear new stations will employ fewer women to top positions. According to Free Press, there is a direct link between women television owners and the hiring of women news directors. Comcast and NBC Universal already controls the bulk of women's cable programs, including Oxygen, Bravo, E, Style, as well as partial ownership of Lifetime. Free Press's Corey Wright says the merger could limit the range of opinions on women shows by crowding out independent producers.
You can limit the representation and portrayal of women because you have one company who's making editorial decisions about the news and entertainment content of those channels.
The public has until August 5th to comment on the proposed Comcast-NBC Universal merger. Leilani Albano, FSRN.
And that wraps up today's program. This is Free Speech Radio News. Thanks for listening. In New York, I'm Doreen Marina.